Welcome to AllThingsTrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Lauren.
It's snowing outside.
It is. It was pretty impressive. Oh, and yeah, and look at that. The volume levels are really nice. I was really concerned because I messed up the mic, like, real bad.
Well, it looks like it's working fine.
Yeah, but it's all right. And it is snowing outside really hard.
Thank you, Seattle DOT, for not salting the roads.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be Seattle if we didn't completely panic at the first sight of snow.
Whenever things are okay, though. I mean, obviously you still have snow, like in the center turnland, wherever it is you're going.
Yeah.
But, like, a lot of the residential roads and, like, the main roads up in Everett soon be okay, at least where I live. And it wasn't really a problem for me driving down here until I got to Seattle, where I saw a bus sideways in the road where I needed to be.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested to see how many people actually show up for game today. Speaking of which, because we should talk about some Star Trek stuff, because not everyone who listens to our podcast lives in Seattle and gives a shit about our weather problems.
Some of them do, I'm sure.
I'm sure. But, all right, so Star Trek RPG.
What about those people? Do you not care about the minority?
If you want to start a separate podcast called Seattle Weather Podcast, we can do that if you want.
Oh, man.
But I'm not
I'll be the best weatherman. I will tell
I'm
you what's going on
in
right
that
now.
Podcast. But I will let you guys know if Bob decides to start this podcast.
I'll give you the traffic report, podcast style.
And the way podcasts work, then we'll get it like a day later, and it will be completely worthless. All right.
Well, like it's worth anything now when you get it in your car?
It could be, in theory. Like, if I could get the traffic report on 520 before I leave work, that would be kind of handy. Because then I would know whether or not to go on 520. But anyway, so last week Star Trek RPG went really awesome.
Shit hit the fan,
yeah,
is what you mean.
Well, like, first the players, you guys captured a major enemy, like, who had been plaguing you for a while. Mm-hmm. So there was some nice closure there. And Jim guest starred as his psychic asshole counselor.
Counselor Croissant, kind of flaky.
Yeah, a little bit. Croissant is his name, and his character is interesting, and he's a full up, he's like a Beta Zed.
Well, he's only half Beta Zed.
Right, but he's half Beta Zed. There's a weird advantage in the Star Trek RPG that when you pick, like, if you have to pay a bunch of points to be half something, and then you get the benefits of both species. It's weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's 6 points for some free.
Well, his character is rad because he's what would be the best analogy for it? It'd be like the civil rights movement almost, but in a much more.
His character is convinced that everyone is discriminating against him for being a telepath.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny because there are like three other telepaths in the group and none of them feel that way. But anyway.
Well, he's trying to fight for the right of for telepaths to be able to read anyone's mind at any time they want.
Yeah.
Is what he wants.
Which I guess I thought about that a little bit, and I guess it sort of depends on if the idea of telepaths is that listening is an active thing, or if people are just constantly broadcasting their thoughts and telepaths have to actively work to shut them out. Because it's portrayed both ways in Star Trek, so it could really go either way. And I've always gone with the former, which is that a telepath has to actively listen. But if it's people constantly broadcasting their thoughts and it's really hard for a telepath to shut them all out, that's a completely different story that I hadn't really thought about. So that would be interesting.
What about Tam Elbrum, or whatever his name was, from Tin Man?
Yeah, that's clearly how it works for him.
You know, obviously we have varying degrees of telepathy. Mm-hmm. You know? Maybe we should talk about that in a future show.
We should, okay. All right, but that's not what we're talking about today.
It's not.
Today
we're going to nerd out so hard.
The last thing that happened Star Trek game was at the end of the session, after the players had gone through this horrible routine to get their main bad guy, the Gorn attacked.
Yeah, oh my god.
So they'll be dealing with that for this session.
They're at war now.
Yep,
and
it's wartime. As of now, we are at war. All right, so today we are talking about Star Trek technology. So we haven't talked really about Star Trek technology since the first episode.
Yeah.
And it's time to get back into that. So, first, a quick recap. What is the point of technology in sci-fi?
And to look cool.
Yeah, well, okay, that's the first one. It should just be window dressing and to be like, you're in the future! And, like, some clear examples of that are, like, for blasters, obviously. Blasters are literally just guns, mm-hmm. but they are futuristic looking, kinda. Whereas the phaser, at least in some instances, is more of a sci-fi weapon because it does something different than a gun. Although we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. The other kind of technology is something that somehow changes the way that humans and characters interact with their setting or changes life in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we talked about the replicator and the transporter last time.
Yep.
And some of the dangers of sci-fi technology is that a lot of the times you introduce an item because you think it's cool or it like is important for a particular plot, that you introduce a thing that does something that you don't really think about it in the grander context of the universe you're living in.
Right.
Like, you know,
it presents a really cool story for the moment, but then it has serious implications later on.
Or like in the case of the replicator, how it was supposed to indicate how much the Federation had grown and how it was like a utopian society where you can make stuff out of thin air. but they didn't really think about how it would affect all the other plots. Like Jim was just watching the episode, what's it called? The one where Nog trades Sisko's desk away. I know that the Great River is in the title, or the Material Continuum or something.
I don't know.
It's a good episode.
I know what you're talking about,
like,
though.
The big conflict of the B plot is that Nog is trading all the stuff to get the parts they need, and one of the things he trades is Sisko's desk.
Yep.
And like O'Brien is trying to replace it. And Jim had just watched it. He was like, why didn't they just replicate
a new desk?
It's like, well, I don't know. Why didn't they? There are so many Deep Space Nine plots that like completely fail if you think that the replicator exists. And it works for other Star Trek stories too. Mm-hmm. But Deep Space Nine especially, because Deep Space Nine is all about like shortages and drama and stuff like that. We already talked about the replicator like 27 episodes ago.
We did.
So go listen to that one.
For those unfamiliar with this discussion, listen to episode 1.
Yeah, that'll talk to
you. You can find it in the archives and on iTunes.
All right. So... And then, of course, there are just the devices that don't make any sense. We're going to get to some of them. But, like, the holodeck, where it's this thing that the way they introduce it is it's this room in the ship that is constantly trying to kill you. and it's, like, it's just weird. It's a device that doesn't work according to actual science. And so it's, like, you have to try to figure out if that's a conceit of the setting that science works differently or if that's just a goof.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know... Like, sometimes it's weird, and sometimes it's not. But, so the first thing I want to talk about is the holocommunicator from, it only appeared twice in Deep Space Nine, in For the Uniform, and once in Dr. Bashir, I presume.
Uh-huh.
And for those of you unfamiliar with those episodes, it was pretty straightforward. It was a holoprojector that both ships would have one, and it would project an image of you to the other ship instead of you having to talk over a view screen.
Right.
And it was Ronald Moore's idea, and Iris Stephen Bear really liked it. Their thinking was that it was difficult to have dramatic confrontations over a view screen, which I don't think is necessarily true. See Wrath of Khan, but I can understand why it would be more difficult because you know you're looking at like a flat TV image, and I know that they thought they were having problems with it. And also Ronald Moore was like, you know, the view screen has been around for like 200 years in the Star Trek universe. Aren't they going to make an advancement of some kind? And the holographic technology just seemed like a natural evolution of it. And it really worked for the Uniform, because that was like Eddington and Sisko having like a big confrontation. And it was a way for them to have their face-to-face confrontation without them actually being face-to-face. So I thought
they would just punch each other if they were actually there.
Yeah, that's what we saw in Blaze of Glory.
That probably helps the actors a lot, too. Because mm-hmm. most of the time, if you look at actually what's going on, they're just talking at a green screen.
Yep, they don't know what's going to be
there. And that's added in later.
When I first started watching Star Trek, I thought that was an actual TV monitor that was on the view screen.
I'm not going to lie, I thought that too when I was younger.
I did not realize that it was a green screen. I didn't know what a green screen was, so, you know, I plead ignorance.
Green or blue, they use one of them.
Yeah, and, like, the holocommunicator was just a really cool thing. It falls into the latter category of sci-fi tech in that it changes the way people interact with each other. It changes the dynamic of the characters, because now suddenly you can have these face-to-face confrontations without actually being face-to-face.
Right.
And, like, you know, as I think I just repeated myself, but that's, you know, it was this really cool device, and it was a really natural extension of holodeck technology, which was something that Deep Space Nine was really good at, was using the holodeck for stuff other than trying to kill people. and, you know, it made that episode interesting, whereas if they'd just been shouting at each other over a view screen the entire time, I can understand why it would have been annoying. It also made it so that the set people didn't have to come up with the interior of a Maquis ship to show in the background.
That's true.
The only thing about it that bothered me was that I wasn't sure if the implication was that Eddington doesn't have any chairs on his ship because he's always standing up in the projections, or if it projects an image of you standing up, no matter what you're actually doing, to try to make you look more, you know, dignified.
Well, the way I was looking at it was more so that you had to have some sort of pad to transmit from, is what it looked like to me, especially when you had Sisko talking to Captain Sanders, I think his name was, in charge of the Malinche,
mm-hmm.
is that he was actually, the Sanders was actually at some sort of holo transmitting pad of some sort, is mm-hmm. what he had to be at. You know, you can see him, like take a couple steps to the right and, like, type on a pad of some sort, or console, whatever it might be. So I don't know if there's actually, like, a console there at the transmitting pad or whatnot, but it looked to me like you actually needed a pad of some sort to transmit from.
That's fair. All right. Yeah, so that would make sense. Maybe their pad just isn't big enough for a chair. but so that's like really the only thing that I could find about it that I didn't like was the standing up thing, which is a really minor point.
Mm-hmm.
But we never saw it again after those two episodes, and I did as much research as I could by going to
Memory
Alpha.
It was a very, very new thing at that point, right? Before the uniform was when? Season 5, I think.
Mid-season
5, right? Yeah. I mean, why install a whole bunch of those all over the fleet or so when you've got a war coming up and you need to ship out a whole bunch of ships?
Well, right. But
I'm sure
it
got installed like a couple of ships.
But we never saw the Defiant use it again either.
Well, no one else had a pad.
Right, probably. But the reason why they didn't use it out of universe.
It could transmit hollow.
Yeah, the reason why they didn't use it like out of universe was, as far as I could tell, was basically that someone behind the scenes, and I suspect Rick Berman, didn't like it for some reason. And apparently in the extras on one of the DVDs, there's a special effects guy who's trying to explain why they didn't use it, and his reasons don't make any sense.
What did he say?
He was saying stuff like because this is his quote from the Memory Alpha page. He was saying it's hard to create a 3D image in a 2D medium, and I was like, wait, what? That's what you do every time you film a person. I don't understand. It is literally filming a person. Like, you don't even have to use green screen.
It's hard to make a 3D image in a 2D medium.
That's the quote, and I haven't actually seen the DVD commentary where this came from, so maybe he has more.
I can understand where he's coming from, I suppose, if they're planning on turning all of DS9 at the time in the mid-90s when all this was being produced into 3D.
That would be funny.
But that's like, you know, kind of before 3D. I mean, they had 3D back in the 50s and whatnot, and they were like, ooh, wow, with the glasses, but it wasn't really anything that spectacular. I mean, we have 3D.
Even today, it's not anything that spectacular.
It's not, because a lot of them don't use 3D very well at all, or use it in a way that really actually matters. Like, Jackass 3 was actually, I think, the best use of 3D I've actually ever seen.
Well, because, like, nowadays what they do is they film...
And it shames me to say that, but it's true.
Well, nowadays what they do is they film the movie in 2D, and then they slap some 3D on it afterwards.
They do, to try to save money and whatnot, because, I mean, filming in actual 3D is expensive.
Yeah.
You know, as far as I know.
Yeah. And I've also heard that one of the reasons 3D is so popular is because it's harder to pirate. I don't know if that's true. But I've heard that that's a thing, and that would be interesting.
Well, I know that mostly how films are pirated upon like initial release in the theaters is usually just someone with a camcorder.
Yeah, just a camera.
Right. So if you have a person with a camera, they're filming literally images that are blurred because you have the different compositions that are going through the glasses to filter.
This podcast does not endorse internet piracy.
No, not at all. But
please download us and share us however you like. We need to get a license for that. Anyway, keep going. Because I just realized that because we don't have a license, people who download this podcast are technically breaking the law. Because I looked into this, and we don't actually have a thing on our website that says it's okay to download these. Like, that's weird. I just realized it.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
they'll change that
anyway,
tonight.
We're going to get on that. But anyway, so the other reason that he lists is that it was thought that people would be confused because they would think that someone had beamed in, which I think is just, I don't understand that. I mean, like, it's pretty clear that they're standing on a holo projector. They got the square on the floor with the lights, and they're all kind of blue to indicate it's a projector. I mean, we've all seen Star Wars. We all know what a holo projection looks like. Like, I think that was like the weirdest explanation I'd ever heard. I think Star Trek fans are smarter than that.
Star Trek fans are, yes. They don't have to sell off some more Trek, though, is the thing. I mean, you and I, the next Trek movie that comes out, we're going to see it. I mean, hands down, they've already got our money, right?
Yeah, well, that's true.
Now, for someone who isn't familiar with Trek and didn't see, like, For the Uniform, who then saw, like, Dr. Bashir, I presume, they wouldn't know what was going on with this guy suddenly just standing there.
I feel like the hologram...
I mean, as far as I recall, there was no saying that the guy was, in fact, just talking from...
Well, I mean, all they have to do is say, activate the holoprojector.
That is a thing that they can do.
It is true. And the Admiral sequence in Dr. Bashir, I presume, they don't ever indicate that he's being projected via hologram. And so that, I could see that being a little confusing.
I mean, so someone who's never seen, like, Star Trek before, for instance.
Although that wouldn't actually... That's not really a transporter confusion. That's just being confused on, is this guy in the room with us?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Or and like, so that I could see. So they'd have to make sure that when they turned on the holo projector, they had a line of dialogue about how you're going to turn on the holo projector now. And we could actually see the hologram materialize, because that looks way different than a transporter effect.
Yeah.
So I think that people will be able to tell the difference that way.
So I sort of agree with them on that second point, is that, you know, there's a better differentiation between someone that's actually in the room and then talking to somebody, which would be like over a view screen.
Although that,
yeah, so I understand his reasoning for that. I mean, the first one with the 3D is just, that's BS, but...
Although you could have a hilarious double take or fake out where someone is talking to someone who they think is actually there, and then the surprise is that it was a holoprojection the whole time.
Ah!
That could have been funny. But anyway, so my verdict on this is I would have really liked to see more of it, because I think it was cool. But we just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why exactly. I have a feeling Rick Berman didn't like it. Because, you know, I hate Rick Berman and I like to blame
Ricky isn't in charge anymore.
Well, no, he's not, right, thank God. So maybe we'll see it again. I don't know. This sounds like the kind of thing J.J. Abrams would like. J.J. Abrams likes flashy Star Wars. Special effects.
He's into Star Wars, and we saw a lot of holo projection in Star Wars. So.
Yeah, we did. All right. So moving on to
at least that was their main method of communication, anyway.
Yeah. Moving on to the next piece of technology is the tricorder.
Yeah, the tricorder.
I know it's kind of blasphemous. And I'm not, and like, I for serious, I do like the tricorder. I don't like how it gets used sometimes, because it's like, the tricorder is basically a magic scanning device that tells us everything about everything. And like, in the original series, like, only one person ever had the tricorder, indicating that it was kind of an expensive and, you know, valuable piece of technology, which a magic scanner that tells you everything about everything really is. I mean, if you imagine, just in modern terms, the amount of gear you'd have to carry around to tell you the stuff that the tricorder can tell you is, like, you'd need, a truck full of gear.
Uh-huh.
You'd need, like, a Geiger counter and a densimeter. That's a real thing, by the way.
Oscilloscope.
A densimeter, a oscilloscope. All, now you're saying words I don't even know. you'd need all this crap, or you can just have a little tricorder thing. So, and that's fine. And the tricorder is very valuable as a narrative device because it allows the characters to pointed at something and say, Captain, this is going on. And it's like, okay, that works fine.
Mm-hmm.
Things became a little problematic in TNG when everyone had a tricorder. It was like, you know, and they gotten much smaller, and it was just sort of like, why does everyone have one? And it got even sillier in Voyager when not only does everyone have a tricorder, everyone always has them out. Like, you know, there's that kind of classic scene from the first episode of Voyager where there's like 8 people standing in the shot and they all have their tricorders out, which at that point you've defeated the entire reason for the entire narrative reason for the tricorder, because everyone can see what's on the tricorder, so they don't have to repeat it out loud. You know, it's like if everyone's playing a video game and everyone's staring at the same screen, you don't have to tell someone, hey, the monster just respawned, we can all see it. You know, and so at that point, you've defeated... Also, it just looks kind of silly when everyone is staring at their tricorder. And, you know, Voyager has the unfortunate trope of not its crew members not being able to identify stuff with it without a tricorder. Or in the case of Torres, when she literally could not identify horse manure without a tricorder. Even with a tricorder, she couldn't tell what it was. And Janeway's like, yep, that's horse poop. It's pretty cool. That's from the 37s, incidentally. The episode where Amelia Earhart shows up and does nothing.
Yep.
Why is Amelia Earhart even in this episode? Although, interestingly enough, that episode does have a nice bit of trivia where Tom Paris indicates the warp 9.9 is about 4 billion miles a second. And I crunched the math.
Oh, really?
And that's actually fairly accurate given the 70-year journey they're supposed to take from where they started to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's about how long it would take at 4 billion miles a second. Now, granted, really? It's obviously the ship can't maintain warp 9.9 for that entire time, so it's going to take way longer. But I was willing to give the writers credit for trying. Like, they, you know, they did some math before they said that number. They didn't just pull a random number out of the air, mm-hmm. which I think is cool, and I wish more people would do that. But all right, we were talking about the tricorder. I'm sorry, I started talking about Amelia
Voyager warp speed being accurate. Intriguing that.
I know, right? And so I just...
Well, now, you know what you need to do now?
What?
Is do the math and figure out what warp 4 is.
Oh,
and,
good.
Or warp 5, and how long it would take to get from Earth to Quonos.
Don't say Quonos. don't say that. You know it hurts. It hurts me in here. I'm motioning
I just
my
go.
Heart.
I just go with what I see, man. I just go with what I see.
See the Klingons on Quonos. Oh, my God. Okay. So that's my main beef with the tricorder, is just that there's too many of them. And it's also sort of a... Just from a perspective of, like... I wish it had stayed kind of bulky, because it's so tiny in TNG.
And it only gets smaller.
Yeah, and it only continues to get smaller. And it's
they got retroactively smaller, too, in Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, they did.
It became like a flip phone, almost.
I don't even know. Did they...
It's something... They had it in the palm of their hand, and something slid out the top.
Yeah, did they even have, like, scanners in Enterprise? I know that T'Pol had one. She had a little, like, iPod-looking thing.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they were... Fairly rudimentary from what I understood of what they actually did.
I wasn't actually sure what they were supposed to do, because I remember
they had like sensors and scanners and stuff, because I mean T'Pol makes a quip in the first or second, it's the first half or the second half when they're looking for the
Klang.
For Klang, but also the other people that
right.
What are the names?
Silic. Silvan?
Yeah, Suluban.
Yeah, well, she says that Vulcan children play with toys that are more sophisticated, and then I don't think we ever see a Starfleet tricorder after that. I'm pretty sure we only ever see T'Pol on her pod.
No, you see it. You see him again. It's like very rarely do you see them. Right. Mostly you see phase pistols.
You do see a lot of phase pistols. Which, speaking of which, the hand phaser. Okay, so we talked earlier about how a hand phaser
I'm not done with the tricorder.
Oh, you're not done with the tricorder?
I'm not done with the tricorder.
Well, you
and this is something that you bring up a lot, is how why it cannot transmit images.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you why it can't transmit images, because the idea of a small device being able to transmit images over large distances wirelessly did not exist yet when they first invented the tricorder. You know, we didn't have phones with cameras yet, guys. But, I mean, that is a little silly. It's like, you know, like watching Best of Both Worlds now when Picard asks Riker to describe the inside of the Borg ship. And it's like, wait, seriously? Your tricorder can give a detailed metallurgical composition in, like, 5 seconds, but it can't transmit a video?
Well, that's probably what the tricorder just is it's just literally taking raw data and putting it in a format you can look at is all it is. I mean, you could send that information to the ship and whatnot, but you still have to interpret what it is right there on the screen. Like, it'll tell you some of what it is, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're scanning a Klingon, it'll tell you, yeah, this is a Klingon.
There's this one sequence in the DS9 episode Rocks and Shoals, which is a fantastic episode, but there's one sequence where one of the extras has her tricorder out, and, like, everyone else has their phasers, which makes sense. You only really need one person on the tricorder. And so she's scanning, and the tricorder prop has, like, a sticker on it. And like normally or
where,
like
where the little screen is, you mean?
Yeah. And like usually they have some kind of effect to make it look like the screen and the buttons are actually moving. But I swear to God, in that scene, they forgot to do that. And it looks like she's staring at a sticker. And I'm like, oh, that's ooh.
It's true. The toy tricorder I had when I was growing up actually had more lice than that.
Yeah, I love those things. I had one of those, too. I also had a toy hand phaser. My mom, every Christmas for, like, 3 years, I wanted my mom to get me a toy phaser rifle. And because, like, the box that I got...
Were those even a thing?
No, but the box that I got the hand phaser in said they were. They were, like, I assume they were some kind of toy that got discontinued, because they were never actually sold, as far as anyone could tell.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom, every year, for, like, 3 years, would dutifully go out and try to find one. So, because, you know, I love my mom.
Shame Craigslist didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I know, right?
Or eBay.
All right.
Thank you, Internet. You've made my life easier.
You indeed have. I just ordered a copy of an old-school PS2 RPG that I haven't played for, like, 15 years.
Which
and I
one's
found,
that?
It's called Okage. It's this, like, kind of satire of JRPGs. You start off as, like, a kid, and you're told to go fight a ghost, and you're given a stick. Go fight a ghost with a stick, and the ghost will completely roll you. It's amazing.
All right.
But anyway, so we're talking about the hand phaser now, unless you do more about the tricorder.
I don't have any more about the tricorder.
So hand phaser. So we were talking earlier about how the hand phaser is actually a sci-fi tool, whereas the blaster is just window dressing.
Because,
mm-hmm. Like, you know, the hand phaser has a stun setting, and it, like, at least in earlier versions of Star Trek, if you shoot someone with a phaser or a disruptor on the high setting, they just vaporize. Mm-hmm. There's no, like, oh, I've been shot in the arm. Oh, no, it hurts.
That was in DS9 all the time, though.
Yeah, that's the first thing on my list, is that in Deep Space Nine, they treat the phaser exactly like a gun. Which I guess is better than Voyager, in which the phaser is actually way less deadly than a gun. Same thing in Enterprise. Like, in Voyager and Enterprise, people get hit with phasers all the time and don't care. Like, there's that really hilarious sequence, again, in the 37s, when Amelia Earhart's co-pilot, who is a historical person, I can't remember his name, but he gets hit by a laser blast from, like, one of the aliens. He gets hit, like, right in the chest and gets thrown backwards. And then he kind of scrambles up and he's fine. And he never even, like, gets medically treated for it. And then there's the same sequence when at one point Chakotay gets shot in the chest, center of mass, by a Kazon weapon, and has a bit of a limp, I guess, to keep the weight off his chest. I don't know. There's a number of sequences where people get shot with phasers in Voyager, especially, but also a little bit in TNG, and it never does anything.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in Deep Space Nine, they literally treat phasers like guns. Like, someone who gets hit by a phaser will bleed out. If they get hit in a not vital area, they will be okay for a little while, but will need medical attention. You could literally just replace the phasers with guns, and you would have exactly the same thing. Which is better than the alternative, but it's still a little disappointing, because these are, like, supposed to be a sci-fi tool, and they've basically just become blasters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that. It also sort of sets up the precedent that the stun setting is more effective than the kill setting. Because usually when they shoot someone on stun, they just fall over. But when you shoot them on kill, it's like, oh, I've been shot. You didn't hit me in a vital place, so I guess I can keep going. And, you know, granted...
Was it ever actually stated that the that a phaser was set to kill and then actually shot somebody and it only caused, like, you know, like just a hole?
I'm pretty sure that when they shoot, like, Jem'Hadar with phasers, they don't have them set on stun. And, like, if they hit the Jem'Hadar center of mass, it will kill them. But if they hit him in, like, the leg
or
something...
Right, but was a Jem'Hadar ever hit with a phaser set to kill and then got back up?
I think so. Actually, the one I'm remembering specifically is when, what's-his-face, Munez, the, like, the B-cast engineer from the ship, the episode of the ship, he gets hit with a Jem'Hadar weapon, and they treat it like a gunshot wound, where, like, he doesn't die immediately or be knocked unconscious. He's okay until it starts to bleed
out.
For
a while, but there was something about the Jem'Hadar weapon that made his wound not clot.
Right, they did that.
I mean, there was something very specific about Jem'Hadar weapons that were that way.
Right, but the point
which
is
I
that
mean, everything
if
about the
Jem'Hadar
weaponry is all about being awful and terrible, and it's like, oh man, you called down the Jem'Hadar, this is what you're going to get.
But
you're gonna get
the point being that
things.
If he'd been hit by a phaser on stun, he just would have been out.
Yeah.
As opposed to being injured. And so a phaser on stun would actually have been more effective in that situation than a Jem'Hadar weapon set on kill. Or whatever the Jem'Hadar weapons are set on. I don't know if they even have multiple settings. Maybe they just always kick your ass. I'm trying to remember a sequence in which someone was shot with a phaser that was, like, at least implicitly supposed to be on kill, even if they never actually said it. And I'm having trouble thinking of one off the top of my head. But I know that I'm positive there's a sequence in which someone gets shot with a phaser and is at least...
We see it with stun.
Yeah.
I know for a fact we see it with stun. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious to see in TNG instances where Data gets shot with a phaser on stun.
Ooh, I know. This wasn't a phaser, it was a disruptor. In the episode where O'Brien gets sent to infiltrate the Orion Syndicate, there's Boothby, I forget the name of his contact, but the guy who, he's like an old guy, and he's like, O'Brien and him are having a friendship and whatever, but the guy who's part of the Orion Syndicate bought some disruptors that didn't
Bigsby?
Work. Bigsby? Yeah.
Is that his name?
I think so. Or Bigsley or something. Anyway, he's mad at the guy who sold him the disruptors, and O'Brien has fixed them, so he shoots the guy in the leg with the disruptor. And the guy's like, oh no, I've been shot in the leg! And he's still alive, and he's still talking. And then, without adjusting the settings, he shoots him in the chest, and he dies. It's like, oh, so I guess that's just a gun, then. I don't know.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that, though, I think.
Hmm?
I mean, obviously with the consistency issues, I have a problem with the consistency issues like anyone else would. But I don't have a problem with the phaser being treated like a gun, necessarily.
I find it, I'm a little disappointed by it.
Because, for the reason that it adds what's the best way to say it? It gives the character more conflict to deal with certain situations, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I can't just stun the individual. I can't just shoot them with a phaser because there's a possibility that if I hit them, they might die, as opposed to going, oh, you're dead, or, oh, you're just out.
Yeah.
Right.
I feel like it was
you have to engage them physically or something.
I feel like it was a step back in terms of how sci-fi-ish Star Trek was, just because it's easier to write stories where the main weapons are guns than when they're, like, you know, weird laser weapons that do things that guns don't do. And I feel like that was a little bit, like, I love Deep Space Nine, I love it with all my heart, but I feel like that was a little bit of laziness on the writer's part, where they were just like, it's just easier to write this story if phasers work like guns, because we all think of weapons in terms of guns.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to say on the phaser rifle. All right, the next thing we want to talk about is spaceships made
rifle?
Out of...
The phaser rifle is a whole different beast.
Did I say the phaser rifle? Okay,
you did,
I meant the hand phaser.
But there's the hand phaser, and then there's the phaser rifle. So why the phaser rifle?
Yeah, that's the other thing, I guess, is that the phaser rifle is like, why does the phaser rifle exist? Since, like, it seems like hand phasers are just as good at killing things as phaser rifles. So, like, I don't know, maybe the phaser rifle carries more shots? It just seems kind of bulky and unnecessary.
I tried figuring it out and looking up, like, specifications and whatnot. I couldn't find any.
I know in the RPG they have exactly the same stats, except that the phaser rifle has more shots. But you can very easily carry a second power pack that is way less bulky than the phaser rifle. So I have no idea what all that...
Intimidation factor.
I guess.
My gun's bigger than yours.
It makes a more effective club. You're trying to pistol at someone with a hand phaser?
Well, I don't know. I recall Picard using the phaser rifle in Nemesis as a club, and it seemed just kind of break.
Let's not talk about things that happened in Nemesis, okay?
but Star Trek universe.
You know what else happened in Nemesis? Admiral Janeway.
Admiral, that did happen.
Yeah, okay. I rest my case. but yeah, the phaser rifle is a little goofy. And again, it's another example of phasers being treated like guns. Because it's like, well, a pistol is a small gun, and therefore a rifle is a larger gun. It will be more damaging, even though it's clearly not the case.
Well, a phaser, though, doesn't have the mechanics of, like, rifling.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, at least as far as we know, anyway.
That's what I'm
saying.
There's
no way you can rifle energy.
They're just treating a phaser like a gun, and assuming that if you scale it up to a longer gun, it will do more damage, which is true of guns because of the way barrels work and shit, but not of energy weapons. Now, I mean, I guess in real life...
Might be an accuracy thing, too.
Maybe. I mean, in real life, I think having a longer weapon helps with, like, if you were going to try to make a laser, an actual laser weapon, because, like, the laser has to bounce around inside a focusing chamber, and the longer the focusing chamber is, the more focused the beam is going to be. So, like, that I could see working.
So maybe it is an accuracy thing, then?
Maybe. Maybe it's more effective over distance. That would make sense. Usually when they use the phaser rifle, it is over, like, big distances, like in Rocks and Shoals, where they have that firefight over, like, this valley.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, yeah, and granted, that's a really well-choreographed firefight. So, you know, I'm willing to give it a pass. The phaser rifles didn't really bother me that much, just looking back on it. All right, so enough with phasers. I want to talk about spaceships made out of wood. all right, so in... I don't remember the name of this episode.
Explorers. Season 4.
Yeah, that's the episode where they find...
and not bald Sisko.
Yeah, that was weird. the never again shall the two meet. But that's the episode where Sisko finds the plans to abjure...
Well, you know why? He wanted to shave his head, actually, initially. And they wanted to have him have a shaved head.
Oh, we're talking about Avery Brooks.
We are, right? But he couldn't do it, if I remember right. He couldn't do it because he would look too similar to another character he did in a previous work.
Really? Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
So that's why you see Sisko for like the first four seasons with hair in his head.
Hmm. He does look better without the hair.
He does look better without the hair.
In fact, at first, when I first saw him, I thought he was a different person. Like, when I first was watching Deep Space Nine and suddenly he shaved his head, he looks way different.
What happened to Captain Sisko?
Who is this handsome devil? but anyway, so the Bajoran ship made out of wood. Is this, like...
Bajoran lightship.
Yeah, Sisko finds the plans for some Bajoran solar sailing ship. And solar sails are a real thing, granted. And mind you, they don't look anything like the way that the
ship... Are there
ship...
actually any solar sails in
yes.
use? Really?
We have a couple of probes that are powered by solar sails.
Really?
Yep. Granted, I mean, they're not very sophisticated probes. They're pretty much just a can of electronics with a solar sail attached to them. But they're going. There's one out there right now.
I'll bet you they're more sophisticated than the Bajoran lightship,
yep.
though.
Because the Bajoran lightship is made of wood. And I'm just going to keep referencing that. Because you don't make spaceships out of wood. I don't care how primitive your spaceship is.
Also, why not? Why not make a ship out of wood?
Because wood doesn't seal very well. Like, you
That's
know,
why you use a sealant.
You can, but why not just use a material that seals better? Like, wood, like, have you ever tried to seal wood? You could do it, but it's really difficult.
We've been doing it for, like, almost 1,000 years with ships.
Yeah, and
we stopped once
we figured out how to make ships out of metal. Because wood is not, like, you know, wood will just get waterlogged. And by the same token, eventually wood will leak out all your air very slowly. You could make a ship that would be airtight for, like, a while. But your air would eventually all just leak out because wood is very porous. And even I don't care, all the varnish in the world isn't going to seal that thing up. You know, to say nothing of the amount of stress a spaceship
has. What kind of wood does Sisko use? Do we ever know?
No,
I think it's from the Jumjaw tree.
That's possible.
I mean, you seen those lollipop things they sell?
Oh my god.
I mean, that's the sap, right?
I guess.
That looks like it'd make a good sealant. Coat the entire side of the ship with that stuff? I think you'd be set.
To say nothing of the amount of the sort of stress that a spaceship has to go through. You know, I don't think wood would protect you from solar radiation very well.
Well, that's why you use the Jumjaw sap.
I see. All right, this all makes sense. And on another point, you can't fly a spaceship without a navigational computer. You can't fly a spaceship by star fixes because you can only see the stars out of a very tiny window in the front of the ship. And he's, like, supposedly navigating with that using, like, a weird sextant-looking thing. And it's like, but you can only see those tiny... What if your ship isn't pointed in the right direction?
What about Apollo 13?
What about Apollo 13?
They didn't have electronics to use.
Yeah, they did.
No, they had to shut them all down.
Right. And then they
had to figure out their course and plot, all with just, like, writing down math. And
right, but this was with data that they had gathered via... They did all the math by hand, but they gathered the data with electronic... with equipment, like, with technology. They weren't just staring out the window. They did eventually do that a little bit. And you'll notice that Apollo 13... That was something that they only did as, like, a last resort in an emergency, being supported by Houston, who had all their instruments working, and, like, only for a minor course correction. Like, granted, a very, very important minor course correction, but a minor course correction nonetheless.
You either crash into the Earth or skip into space.
Yeah. I mean, if they, you know, if anyone went to, like, a space program and said, all right, guys, we're going to do all of our navigations by hand using star fixtures, Also, you'll notice Apollo 13 has a bigger window than the Bajoran solar ship does.
I don't know about that.
It's got more windows, too, because it's got the one on the front of the capsule, and then it's got some in the lunar module. So, like, they got more windows to look out of. And also, Apollo 13 was already pointing in the right direction. Like, you know, can you imagine what would happen if they had been pointing in the wrong direction and they had no way to maneuver their ship? It would be bad, okay? Let me tell you. And also, spaceships can't be made out of wood. Also, Sisko apparently installed gravity plating because doing an entire episode in zero-G would have been expensive, but he left the bathroom in its zero-G condition, and that doesn't work. I don't know if you've ever tried to poop on the space shuttle, but it doesn't work if there's gravity. Let me tell you. That's not the way the bathrooms work.
I can't say I've ever tried.
I went to space camp.
I can't say I've ever been in a zero-G environment. I mean, I'm a scuba diver, but I mean, that's not really zero-G.
I mean, the point is that, like, stuff that's designed to be used in zero-G, if you suddenly turn the gravity back on, it's like, huh? And then that entire premise of, it was pretty clear that the only reason there was gravity was because the people who made the episode didn't want to have to deal with filming the entire thing in what looked like zero-G. And it was just weird that Sisko was like, he was super hardcore about everything being exactly right except the gravity. That he was willing to go for. And I was just like, oh, yeah, okay. I don't understand. Also, you can't make spaceships out of wood. Anyway.
But the Jumjaw tree, or the Jumjaw tree.
This is something that...
It's a spaceship coated in candy.
This is something that my dearest Lillian asked me to include, is Ractigino. Which isn't really a device, technically speaking, but I think I'm willing to let it slide. Which, for those of you who don't remember, Ractigino is Klingon coffee.
That everyone drinks.
Yeah, which started off as just, like, this cool thing. It was like, oh, look, they drink things that are not just from Earth. Like, you know, it's like, not everyone is drinking Earl Grey.
How multicultural of them. Ooh.
Right, but then, as Lillian points out, everyone drinks it by, like, the end of the show. Like, yep. Everyone is drinking Klingon coffee, and it's like...
It's very annoying.
It's like, what's the difference between Klingon coffee and regular coffee?
It's even more annoying. Like, I don't know how much of this you've done, but I did a lot of simulation, like, fanfic writing, where you're running with other players on, like, a ship.
Well, I mean, I did some of that with you.
Oh, that's right, of course. And a lot of players would also drink Ractigino with their characters, and it was kind of, it was a little annoying.
Especially since I always assumed that, like, Klingon coffee would be stronger than human coffee, right? So, like, but, like, everyone drinks it, and it's just, like, it would have been cool if, like, it was just Sisko and Dax, but it's everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, it makes even less sense for, like, Kira to drink it, because, like, there's this whole thing, like, a lot of Bajoran culture seems to be based around relaxing. Like, the way that Bajorans give birth is relaxing until the baby comes out.
Yep.
Which is, you know, a way cooler way than humans give birth, if I had to take my pick. But, like, it just seems weird that Kira drinks this super coffee. And granted, there is a little bit of precedent for Kira just not liking Bajoran food, but, like, you know, with the Jumjaw, we keep coming back to these freaking Jumjaw sticks. But anyway.
Wooden spaceship, also candy.
Can't make a ship out of wood.
Candy spaceship, Orin.
But anyway, it just, like, it started off as this cool thing, but then it just became background noise. Like, yep. Everyone just drank Ractigino, and we never actually see a single Klingon drink Ractigino. Maybe that was an in-joke, I don't know. But I just, you know.
Klingons troll the Federation with their coffee, quote-unquote.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe it's like how everyone talks about how Morn is really loud and Morn never talks. So, like, you know, that's just a running joke. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was an oversight, I don't know. But it kind of bothered me. All right, and on to another device. Self-replicating mines. Seriously, what the crap? I don't understand. Like, okay, so in this mine, you have a cloaking device and a replicator big enough to produce another mine of the same size, and a power source to power both of those things. Where is the warhead in all this? Where exactly is this mine's, like, explosive kept? Like, this, there's so little of this mine is used for actual mine stuff that it's kind of mind-boggling. Mind-boggling? I made it funny.
That was lame, Orin.
It was great.
That was like, that's like wooden starship lame.
Oh. Oh. Also, what does he use to replicate another mine? Does it just have a store of condensed matter inside? What? I mean, like... You know, I guess you could assume that...
Right, because most warheads of this type are antimatter warheads, and you can't replicate antimatter.
You can't. And maybe it's, I don't know, maybe these mines use a more conventional explosive. But even if that's the case, where does it get the matter to replicate more mines? Like, does it reach out into space and grab the matter from the mine next to it that just exploded? Because that seems unlikely. Because, like, the matter's going to be everywhere. There's nowhere they're going to be able to get all of it. It seems like the Cardassians could have just destroyed this minefield by shooting at it a bunch. And, like, eventually it would have just run out of juice.
Yeah. It's...
And, like,
I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, and then, like, just looking at it from that same perspective, it's like, well, if you can make self-replicating mines, why don't you make self-replicating torpedoes? Just fire the torpedo, but then it gets to the target. There are like 50 torpedoes because it keeps replicating more torpedoes, each of which has a replicator in it. Oh my goodness, this is like a Russian doll crazy. Yeah, the self-replicating mines are just silly. And like, it was, I don't really know what their plan was on that. I think it would have been way more, what they really should have done with these mines is done like the more classic sci-fi approach to mines, which is that
the whole idea was they needed a way to be able to block the Dominion from coming in.
You know what they
should
have done?
From a storyteller perspective.
They should have had the mines be inside the wormhole. And then they, like, granted, they couldn't collapse the wormhole. They'd already established that.
That's going to go over well with the Bajorans.
Yeah, whatever.
So your celestial temple, right? Here's what we want to do. We're going to go inside that temple. We're going to put explosives everywhere.
We're going to put mines in your temple. but what they should have done was have the mines be, like, weapons platforms as opposed to actual explosives. Because when you think about it, a mine is pretty worthless in space unless it has some way of moving to its target anyway. Because space is so big. But if they had been like stationary weapons platforms inside the wormhole, they could have put in some technobabble about how the mines could acquire targets, but the Dominion ships trying to come through couldn't, and it just would have been a big turkey shoot. Like, that at least would have been a little more interesting than the self-replicating mine, which was literally just a magic wall that was. It was basically like the Federation just put a wall of force for, you know, our D&D fans. Just put a wall of force in front of the wormhole and then left. So anyway, self-replicating mines, I don't like it, and I don't know, like, again, it just doesn't, there's nothing about it makes any sense, and it's just weird.
Well, I know in the notes you had put that that mining in space doesn't make any sense, period.
Yeah, well, I mean, I give it a little bit more credit with the wormhole because the ships are coming out of a very specific point, but in space, if you're putting down mines, the mines have to be able to move, otherwise... Because space is so big, the chances of a ship actually colliding with a mine are almost negligible. Even if you put them in a busy shipping lane, it's like, space is huge! That's like the constant of space, okay? And I like to say this a lot, it's one of my favorite lines. No matter how big you think space is, it's bigger than that. Okay? That is like one of the definitions of space, is that it is really big. Not definitions, excuse me, but core traits of space, is that it is enormous. I don't care how many mines you scatter around. The chances of one of them actually hitting anything are effectively zero unless the mine can change its position to intercept a target. So the mines really need to be able to have engines of some sort, which is fine. I mean, whatever. Like, I would assume that the mine, its engine would also double as the explosive. That's how most sci-fi does mines. If you're looking at any kind of hard sci-fi, usually what it is it's not so much an explosive as it is an engine that detonates on contact. And so it's like, you know, the mine detects a ship. It's like, oh, look, a ship! Whee! And it just, like, you know, runs at him and boom. But that's not how mines...
Sounds like a Japanese Zero.
Oh, ooh, okay.
Just minus the pilot.
Minus the pilot. That's good. All right. No, we're not going to make kamikaze jokes here. Okay.
I wasn't making a joke. I was actually making a serious comparison.
Okay, well, that's good. All right.
Where are you going with that?
I don't know. I thought you were making a World War II joke. I was trying not to run with it.
Well, I could run with it. I mean, they actually set up a lot of mines out in the ocean.
Yes, they did, because oceans are relatively small compared to space.
Compared to space.
And you can set the mines up in a line instead of needing to set them up in a wall.
Well, a wall is a line.
Kind of.
Just, you know, across your path.
A wall is a series of lines. If you get enough lines together, you can eventually make a wall. Are there anything more to say about these mines?
I don't have anything to say about them.
All right. Well, the last device that I have on my list is the mind erasing machine, which is I don't know if they ever actually gave it a name, but it's this thing, and I think they mentioned somewhere that Dr. Pulaski, pioneered this technique, which would totally make sense and would just another reason for me to hate Pulaski. But it's this machine that they have that can take memories out of people. It can just, like, erase memories from your brain.
Yep.
And they use it in a couple of episodes, like Pen Pals and Who Watches the Watchers. And the last one that I can remember them using it in is The Sons of Moog. And it appears to be this... It doesn't seem to have any kind of negative side effects. It just erases memories with, like, apparently perfect accuracy.
Not with perfect accuracy.
Really?
Who Watches the Watchers? The whole premise of that was that the guy remembered something.
Well, right, because it doesn't work on that species. That was a specific species thing.
Uh-huh.
But on species that it does work on, it works 100%. Either works
or... It works 100% of the time, 90% of the time, or is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it doesn't
Or what? In this case, it's three episodes, so 66% of the time works 100% of the time.
What I'm saying is that it doesn't have an error ratio, okay? It has a toggle switch. It's either on or off. There's no in-between. And so, okay, so the thing about it, first of all, in the Sons of Moog, I just really don't buy their whole, it's not okay to kill Kern, but it's okay to destroy who Kern is as a way to kill him. Like, because, you know, the Sons of Moog is the episode where Worf's brother comes back and is dishonored and it wants Worf to kill him.
Right.
And Worf's told he can't by Sisko, and they're sad for a while. And then eventually they come up with the idea, Dax comes up with the idea of using the mind eraser to erase all of his memories and make him pretend, think he's a new person. And it's like, all right, like, I guess, I just, that seems like you killed him. I don't understand why Sisko would be okay with this, because it's basically, I mean, heck, Babylon 5 had this thing called the death of personality, where they, and that's not just a Babylon 5 thing, that has been in other sci-fi where...
You have to elaborate, because I didn't watch a whole lot of Babylon 5.
Well, the death of personality was an execution method, where they would literally just erase who you were. Like, they would erase your personality and your memories, and then... You would be, and then in Babylon 5, you would then be put to work as, like, you know, some kind of menial laborer or something, serving the, you know, to try to serve society. The idea being that they had killed the person who had done whatever the crime was, and then they still had a perfectly useful worker who could repay society.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that's come up in a couple other sci-fi stories, and I can't name them off the top of my head. But in most sci-fi, it's pretty well recognized that destroying someone's memory and personalities is at least on par with killing them. You know, you've created a new person out of it, but you still killed somebody. That person no longer exists. Who they were is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed like a huge cop-out in Deep Space Nine to just pretend that this was, like, a complete solution to the problem. And, like, no one thought it was not okay. And I feel like the Federation would have laws against that sort of thing. But apparently they don't. I guess mind erasure's not murder. Especially since it wasn't willing mind erasure, too. They didn't, like, ask Kern, hey, you want to have your mind erased? So I don't... Although...
I don't know, I feel some of that would touch on something like Terry Schiavo, myself personally.
Oh, with the... Yeah, that's yeah, a fact.
At some point, you're just keeping biomass alive, right?
Yeah.
That's all you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... I feel the what the real argument there would be, is it okay to terminate biomass that can be, you know... still living,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to killing someone's personality, because the personality is already dead.
Well, but the difference there is that when Kern has his memory erased, he's not a vegetable, he just has amnesia. Like, he's still a living... The person that now exists in Kern's body is effectively a newborn, in that he has no memories.
Well, all his skills are intact.
His skills are intact, which is weird. That's not how amnesia works. But that's how amnesia works in fiction. But, like, the point is that he's become a completely new person, but he's still, like, the person that they've created is still capable of life, and is not just a mass of tissue. But they had to kill a person to do it, so it's sort of like, I don't know, if you bring it down to its pure mathematical terms, that would mean that killing someone's okay as long as you have a baby immediately afterwards. Because you've replaced them.
Keep the amount of biomass in the universe the same.
Maintain the population levels. And, like, so that's just silly. But coming at it from a more logical perspective, it's a really bad precedent to set that you can just erase people's memories whenever you want to. Because there are so many instances in Star Trek where it would have been useful for one side or the other to just be able to do that. Like, the one that really comes to mind off the top of my head is when Bashir told Section 31 where they could shove it when they tried to recruit him. And they just let him walk away. And he knew all about Section 31 suddenly, when, like, Section 31's entire secret is that, like, their biggest advantage is that no one knows that they exist.
Section 31's always a step ahead.
Right, I know.
Always.
But that completely bites them in the ass later. Like, you know, the fact that they did this ends up getting Sloan. I like saying spoilers, okay? The fact that they...
It slays me every time you say that.
The fact that they told Bashir about this and then let him walk away with full knowledge of their organization leaked that knowledge to all of Bashir's friends, plus anyone that they felt like telling. And then Bashir later uses his knowledge of Section 31 to trap and inadvertently kill Sloan and undo their entire, you know, founder genocide program. Whereas if they had just put Bashir through the memory eraser, none of that would have happened. And that just seems like it should be standard procedure when you try to recruit someone and they say no. It's like, okay, get in the memory eraser. We don't want you to know what we're all about. And, like, then there's other situations like...
Well, Section 31's case is that I think how they had engineered that whole situation was more or less they had the contingency of either he would become a Section 31 agent, in which case we would have this really awesome agent now, or we would still have an asset that we could screw and dick around with later on if we need to. Inter Armas Silent Legis.
Right. But
prime
could,
example of that.
They could totally have still done what they did in Inter Armas Silent Legis without Bashir knowing what Section 31 was. Like, that wasn't required. That was a fake out for the viewers more than anything else. From an in-universe perspective, his knowledge of Section 31 was not necessary.
No, but he knew who Sloan was.
Right.
And that was integral to the whole plot in the first place.
Well, that was how they framed the plot because of what Bashir knew. But if Bashir just didn't know what Section 31 was, they could have framed the plot differently to get him to do the same thing. Because what they were banking on in that instance wasn't that Bashir knew about Section 31. What they were banking on was that Bashir would do the right thing. And try to help this Romulan senator woman. And they could have very easily maneuvered him into doing that without him knowing what Section 31 was. And at that point, he would have come out, like, just really confused and not knowing what just happened. And he might have even thought that he did something good. And then Section 31 never would have had to deal with him trapping Sloan in the mind-reading machine. Which is different from the mind-erasing machine, by the way. The mind-reading machine that Bashir uses on Sloan is the one where that basically teleports you into their mind. You get, like, a little avatar walk around in their brain. Like, it's a holoprogram or something. Which is a cool episode, don't get me wrong. But And then there's also the... I can't help but wonder during, like, Homefront, when the Admiral asshole is, like, doing a coup, like, and Sisko finds out about it, it would put Sisko through the memory eraser. And erase the coup from Sisko. Sisko just wouldn't know what happened. He'd be like, what's going on here, guys? What have I been doing for the last couple weeks? And like, well, you got here and you were put in a coma. And it was bad.
Put into a coma.
A changeling attacked you and you've been in a coma for like 2 weeks. Never mind that I am now in charge of the Federation.
Never mind that.
Do not pay no attention to the Admiral behind the curtain. And there are a number of situations. And if like the Federation has it, it only makes sense that other races would have it. And like, I mean, I don't know. Like, especially like maybe... Well, no, never mind. I was going to say the episode where the Obsidian Order captures Kira and makes her look like a Cardassian. But their entire plan in that instance revolved around Kira not accepting that she was a Cardassian. So if they'd erased all of her memories, that wouldn't have worked.
Do Cardassians have that tech?
I assume that they would. Because it's very, very valuable.
Know.
Well, it's very, very valuable for Cardassians.
I don't
Cardassian,
know. Excelsior
like,
kills Galar at 30 paces.
Look, the Cardassians can apparently implant false memories. Because they made the actual daughter of that guy think that she was a Bajoran. So, like, I assume that if they can implant false ones, they can erase old ones. We had the same thing with the undercover lady that falls in love with Odo, and I don't remember the name of that episode, but the one where she's one of the people who have that really neat neck implant that lets them interface with computers directly to the brain.
Oh, yeah, that's really bizarre.
Which is another piece of tech I should have put on here. Because that piece of tech is kind of cool, and we only ever see it twice. I think more people should have that. But, like, we know that her species, whoever they are, can do the same thing. They can erase and implant memories. So, like, being able to implant being able to erase memories is certainly valuable. But being able to implant them, oh my goodness, that is, like, the most valuable piece
Inception.
Of tech you could possibly have. It's like, the moment you capture an enemy agent, at that point you can turn them and make them do whatever you want. Because you just implant a bunch of memories that make them do what you want them to do. Like, I mean, you know, imagine what happens. Imagine if the Federation... Now, granted, the Federation is probably all moralistic and stuff and wouldn't do this. But imagine the Federation captures Gul Dukat. They implant in Dukat's memories him discovering that the Dominion is secretly planning to annihilate all of Cardassia. And then they send him back to Cardassia to try to fight the Dominion. Throws the entire Dominion-Cardassian alliance into chaos, paves the way for Federation-Klingon victory. Now, obviously, the Federation would probably not do that, because the Federation are nice guys. Mm. And they're not about, you know, messing with people's brains if they don't have to. Mm. We're making the side-of-hand gestures here.
I don't know.
But, like, can you imagine one of the other powers? Like, the Cardassians doing that. Like, you know, the Cardassians, like, capture...
The Romulans did do that.
Yeah, the Romulans did that with Geordi. Mm-hmm. I completely forgotten about that episode. Thank you. The Romulans do that with Geordi. Well, in the episode where the Cardassians accuse O'Brien of smuggling warheads? What if they just implanted memories in O'Brien of him smuggling warheads? Like, what if they just did that? And he actually thought he smuggled the warheads?
No, my goodness.
That would have been, like, that would have made their entire plan go without a hitch, because O'Brien would probably have, you know, confessed at that point. Or at least he would not have been so ardent in his own defense.
Uh-huh.
And Odo probably would have been like, hey, do you actually smuggle warheads? And he would have been like, yeah, okay.
I did. That was me.
I'm sorry, guys. My bad. Mea culpa. and so really, that is such a valuable piece of technology that goes so underused. And the only people who ever used it to its natural abilities were the Romulans. And they only ever did it once. And it just seems like a really, really obvious...
Well, it's probably a long, lengthy process.
Yeah, well, in that episode...
That's very expensive.
Yeah, but it is so worth it. I mean, come on.
As long as you strike precisely with it and use it in good instances. I mean, in the case of the Romulans, that was jeopardizing the whole Klingon Federation Alliance, for instance, right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a very good instance for them to use that in. For O'Brien smuggling warheads, I don't know. Probably not so much.
Maybe. Maybe it would have... And that would have been interesting to give, like, telepaths something else to do in this universe. Because you could have telepaths who you employ specifically to scan people and make sure that they're not all messed up. Yep, you've been arrested for thought crime would never be the same again.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, well, whew, okay, so we have anything else to talk about?
I don't think so. Nothing that comes to mind for me, anyway.
All right, well, next episode, I think next week, Bob and I should each list our top 5 episodes of Star Trek.
Oh, man, it's going to take forever. It's going to be a long episode.
I think it'll be good. I mean, we might have to split it into 2 parts, but I think it'll be good.
No, all one sitting. I'm going to make you suffer through this.
All right, all going. All right, well, we will see you guys next week. This is All Things Trek, signing off.